Yeah, so we got on the couch. This old white motherfucker.
Hey, my name is Richard Price. Primarily, I'm a novelist and a screenwriter. This was my first episode of The Wire.
You kidding? Look around. Take your pick. So the old man, he's like the Poe House, the Elwood Allen Poe House.
Shit, you back all right?
Switch the mic, yo. I'm like, I don't know no
Elwood Omar. Allen Poe. He's got such a strange charisma because he's an unregenerate gay street hunter. He's the only guy who acts outside of prison. Like people would act by necessity in prison when it comes to, you know, human love. And he's untouchable. When David said, all right, you get to introduce Omar, he's got to rob a house, safe house, and score some dope. You know, it was sort of like starting off the Olympics by being the guy who put the torch in the big thing after it's been running around the world. The good thing about Omar and people like that is that they will never give a character more scenes simply because he caught on with the public. I mean, beware what you wish for. If you had an Omar spinoff, I mean, so that would be like that guy Kramer having his own spinoff from Seinfeld. I think it's so much better to keep people tantalized and wanting more.
Shit.
You know, then feeling sort of bloated.
Nah, nah, nah.
Hey, yo, Omar. Yo, all due respect, but this right here is a Barksdale joint, man.
Do tell.
I also feel like this show has the greatest theme music and collage. I used to watch the show in the first 2 years before I was involved. And brothers, it's just the best.
He got fired in a fury at his command.
I think the collage is like poetry.
You think this boy woke up yesterday morning, sat on the edge of his bed, and said, today's my day to die?
I wrote this after going to, the Essex County Morgue, where they had a bunch of kids from the Newark public school system. They called, quote, at risk. And Scott tried to scare the crap out of them with pulling out hearts and organs to show them that we do die. These kids couldn't have been more bored. I think it made them think of lunch.
I'm like bored stiff. What's the deal with this?
I go down to MCI Jessup hoping to pull up a fellow with some years on him, see if he's ready to share his feelings. Turns out Barksdale D'Angelo got himself rung up as a suicide, DOD of 72103.
Well, who worked it?
State police.
Can we pull the post-mortem on this?
Yeah, he's kind of a made guy down there. I just want to make sure nobody did the suicide to him.
Yeah, ain't nothing but dust and bricks over there now.
Shit, all the battling we did to take them towers, man. You trying to tell me we back on the street with the rest of them?
Anyway, B, now the towers is gone. Everybody know how it got to go down. I say we send our people over there early, corner chiefs, like, yo, we here now. You know what I mean? But we bring something to the table. Lay it out like it's their lucky day.
Mm-hmm.
No flexing, no threats. Just be like, this is a good thing.
Yeah, but you know, we're gonna need good corners. That's what we're gonna need close to downtown. Get the workaday trade. I'm talking about like...
When I wrote this scene, I originally had Idris Shah quoting Martha Stewart saying it's a good thing. I guess I thought that was too much to bring up Martha Stewart.
I wanna see if we're gonna fuck this up now that the towers are down. You know what I'm saying? They measuring us up. I want to see if we're going to be weak or real.
If for full step to us, man, we're gonna do what we gotta do. But it's them bodies that got you in here. If we can do this about the bodies, we should. You know what I mean? Especially now we light on muscle.
Speaking of muscle, man, you hear from that man I sent you?
Yeah, Cuddy from the cut. Yeah, he ran. We took care of him.
Good, good.
How you fix the hearing?
Oh, it's all good, man. Shit. Levy got everything straightened up tight for me, man. I'll be home for a good cold.
Terrace came down.
This series of scenes is when they have to speak to the various street crews to make room for them coming from the terraces. And each guy has his own little sales pitch.
Now, how you figure that?
To get the guy to cooperate.
37,
38.
Yo, we can go 31, 32 shots, man. The shit's so John Blaze. You can step on it 7-8 times and still take the cake.
Actually, he got that hat from a production of The Crucible.
Yo, y'all seen Marlo? Y'all ain't seen him? Y'all know him?
Marlo? Yeah, yeah, he was here. Now he ain't.
Jesus, Tommy. I like the shit. When I looked up, saw you on the news giving it to Irv. You fucker, you're up to something.
I'm up to nothing, I'm telling you. I can help him, he can help me. Little itch here, little
these political
there.
Scenes that involve anybody from this City Hall, they were like calculus to me. Basically, all you do is... All I did was call up Bill Zorzi, who's the... a political expert on the show and take dictation. I watch these things as if I hadn't written them.
Get yourself a snitch in the mayor's inner circle. So, what's my role in your little drama?
Thought you might broker a meeting. You know? Help your fearless leader see the light about his new friend on the council.
And I should tell him what? Make nice or invest heavily in petroleum jelly?
Hey. His ass. His choice.
You didn't talk to him?
I couldn't find the motherfucker.
Man, we just walk up. We're going to bump.
There. Middle of the block. Right there.
Yo, where that whistle at?
It's interesting, the language changes like almost weekly out on the streets. It's like what was last week's whistle is this week's hammer. At some point in 100 years, they'll call it a gun again. One of the good things about this show is they really try to get... I mean, some of these people are very seasoned actors and very savvy actors. They've kind of been flying under the radar, which is good for the show because you don't want to break the credibility of the show by somebody stopping in their tracks and going, oh my God, how did they get Robert De Niro on the show? I mean, you want skill, but you want people that won't take the viewer out of the picture by saying, what else was he in? Yeah, I remember that guy. You just want people to fall into the wire. And sometimes the downside of that, with the lesser experienced actors, a lot of the kids, a lot of the scenes in which there's banter between kids, what you get in the trade-off is these magnificent faces and presences. There's no Oliviers out there on the street. It's a visual medium. As much as, you know, David and I and other people would like to think it's about the writing, it's not. It's about the screen. And so there's always that trade-off. The faces will rule.
Anybody I want?
Anybody.
I want more than one. I want the Olsen twins.
You got them. Slaves. All they live for is to get you off.
But so now who are you going to do for him? One guy, one act, one time.
This whole sexual banter between these guys. You're gonna be like, when he has to come up with a fantasy woman to sleep with, he comes up with the Olsen twins. This is right before the Olsen twins broke again. So it was really an obscure reference. Now it looks like it just picked up a newspaper.
Both Olsen twins. Ashley. Kate. Mary Kate. And yeah, I mind their body of work. They're yours. All you gotta do is name a guy. I'm not catching, I'm pitching. No problem.
No screenwriter was actually hurt in the filming of this scene.
Tournament out of the pit.
The whole dogfighting thing is, you know, sometimes the greatest fear of a writer is you're asked to write about something that you have no idea, you have no information on, you've never experienced. And one of the greatest thrills for a writer is to realize that you can actually learn something, and you don't need that much. And then you can write in a very plausible way about it. It's like earn while you learn. And the dogfighting scene, I have no interest, never seen a dogfight. George Pelicanos, who is another writer on the show and a producer of season 3, just did research on a dogfight for one of his novels. And he just gave me a couple of advanced pages of his book to set me up with the details. And that's all I needed. I mean, the thing that people remember for a writer, for myself, is what I feel like the most memorable things are the very small things. You know, you would hang out with cops. I would hang out with cops, you know, on and off for years. And they see what I wind up writing, whether it's Clockers or The Wire or whatever. And they always feel like, well, we showed him a multi-million dollar drug bust, and he writes about this idiot, you know, buying a crack pipe in a bodega. Because the idiot buying the crack pipe in the bodega is the life. There are more idiots buying crack pipes in bodegas than there are these big News at 11 scores. And that's where the life is. If you do watch this scene carefully with the editing, you see, thank God, you know, no animal was hurt. Just a movie, because in real life this happens all the time, sort of everywhere. One of the great things about this show is it's all about the gray areas. There's no good guys, no bad guys.
Like,
people see each other every day in the street, the dealers, the cops, and they just get to know each other, and it's life.
The short one with the Coke bottle glass.
David always told me that, you know, part of his inspiration for this series was this novel I wrote, Clockers, that Spike Lee made into a movie.
Yo.
And it was about the back and forth between the cops and the kids and how everything in the world is the gray area.
I go into all the cities,
and there are two favorite scenes of his that I had where these cops come out of a mini mall, having just seen Parenthood with Steve Martin. And then all the kids that they bust come out of the two surrounding theaters, one seeing like Nightmare on Elm Street and the other one, you know, seeing, you know, I Suck Your Blood, Part 15. And the cops are completely surrounded by these kids that they just make miserable every day of their lives. And the kids react to them in awe, because it's like seeing your teacher at a urinal. Like, oh, Mr. Smith, I didn't know you had a dick. You know, I mean, the cop is braced for trouble, but the kids are just turned into like these childlike, can't imagine seeing a cop coming out of a movie like they would. And it was about, you know, these small, little, but those are the areas. That's the stuff I like to write about.
What you want us to do?
I really don't care about the giant score, you know, like the photo array of, like, packets of giant bricks of cocaine. You know, I mean, that's not where I live. I mean, the other things, the smaller things, is where I feel like I live.
Your boy really jammed me. That little prick is all over the news.
Mm. You did not look particularly commissioner-like.
And Mayor told me the same thing.
You can't have that shit every week. Not if you want his honor to give you the job permanent. Tommy's a good kid, usually. And asks Payne when he wants something. But mostly good people.
I don't give a shit what he is.
Well, you can't have him pounding on you, Irv. Throw him a bone. He'll take care of you.
All right. But I draw the line had gone behind the mayor for this guy. You can't sit where I'm sitting and backdoor the fucking mayor.
Sorry I'm late, guys. The kid at a Little League game started late.
Well, I'll leave you boys to it. And what I have brought together, let no man tear asunder.
He win?
Who?
Your kid, his team.
Oh, shit, who keeps score?
I mean, yeah, it's a little hectic, but everybody's stepping off at the right time.
These corner boys we dealing with, I don't think they even listen to their own people.
Yeah, I'm gonna talk to peoples. Where you at?
Marlo? I can't find him. And you told us not to start nothing, so I set up in the middle of the block. You know, even that got hard stairs. I don't... They ain't gonna hold, I don't think.
That is Marlo. How hard you looking for him? Like, why aren't you out there looking for this motherfucker right now?
Because you called this meeting here.
Shut the door.
I love to have a corporate board meeting in the funeral home they own.
What's your good news, man?
Omar right inside the stash.
Robert's rules of order.
Already bowed, 600. Cocksuckers even took my watch.
Second stash this month, they didn't got two.
I mean, he called you by name.
One of the great things about this show is that there's no sentiment, no sentimental nobility. So when anybody does act with any kind of fragment of honor, it's magnificent.
All right, man, double the muscle on every stash we got. And if the man coming, make ready for the man.
It's not personal. I swear to God, it is not.
In scenes like this, in which it's very coded political back talk, where people are talking about something that they're not really talking about, but they're most definitely talking about. And it involves incremental moves on a chessboard between the police bureaucracy and City Hall and how people scratch each other's back. I have no idea about how that works. And when I have to write a scene like that, I feel like Helen Keller on a snowboard in the Alps. I have to be guided through that. And I'll sit with Bill Zorzi. I'll talk to Bill Zorzi on the phone, and I'll say, okay, do I understand the general thrust of this scene? He is trying to convince the commissioner to give him something to do for the commissioner, to convince him that this ambitious congressman, help me help you, which is a con line that cops always use on suspects. But now he's saying it to the police commissioner. Help me help you. Let me give you something that you need. Breaking down the guy's mistrust until the guy confesses that he's got dozens of police cars in a repair shop and they're not getting repaired. The next thing, voila, all those cars are back out on the street because the politician sort of wiggled his fingers and five people died in Oklahoma and here are the police cars. But it's a seduction, you know, and then tell me more, tell me more, tell me more. And then ultimately, way down the line, you find out that this assemblyman, starting out with trying to get on the good side of this police commissioner, is really running for mayor. But you don't find that out for a very, very long time.
So how are you going to play it?
And like I said, on these scenes, I'd so much rather watch them than write them.
I know.
But it's all part of the job.
Coming home too. Well, if you're inclined to work something out, that's one thing.
I don't know if those are $10,000 car rims or huge exhaust fans.
So if you want to hold on to what's
yours, look with that blue light, though.
You best be ready.
Remember that Barksdale kid? One who took all the weight? Tied his neck to a doorknob in the prison library, sat his ass down.
I don't know. Men of color usually don't do themselves. I mean, take me, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, you got all the reason in the world.
And yet, here I am. Still standing.
Give or take.
Looked at the scene photos?
Nah, there ain't none. State police dogged them. My turn, Bunk. Come on. Go with number three.
All right. play my song, darling? Huh? Play the right song.
Hey, Bunk.
It make you hit the high notes, baby.
Some hey, Bunk.
Hey, look, I saw it first, Jimmy.
Come on, man.
Come on, baby. Knock it out.
Nah, the baddest nigga of all time.
Who?
This nigga from New York, from the olden days. Bumpy something.
Bumpy? He's talking about Bumpy Johnson.
He do shit like run up to a police station by himself.
Nah. Probably the first like great, like, Bumpy, you know, sorry, large, larger-than-life urban black gangster. He reigned in New York, in Harlem. He was, you know, worked for the mob, ultimately, because that's the way it was in America, if you were black. But he was the king of Harlem for about 40 years, from the 1920s to the 1960s. And he was so feared by the police, even, that there was an incident in which the police had raided one of his whorehouses or one of his numbers joints. And he just sort of barreled into that police station, just kicked the door in. And the cops' reactions were, it's Bumpy, and everybody just ran for the hills, like hid behind the big desk, and they just said, "Oh, Bumpy, what did we do?" What? Now, I remember reading that. The one who wrote about that anecdote was Jimmy Breslin, the journalist emeritus. He's sort of like that sort of working class liberal voice in American journalism. Jimmy Breslin also said something else, which is very true about The Wire and the people who create The Wire. He was talking about Damon Runyon. And he said that Damon Runyon did what all good journalists do. He hung out. And the thing that I know about Ed Burns and George Pelicanos, and I don't know Dennis Lehane that well, but my guess is Dennis Lehane and very much David Simon is, and myself, is we all love to hang out. We just, we're great believers in osmosis. If you're just there, turn yourself into a sponge, learn. What's important will stay with you 2 days later. The trickle-down theory of osmosis. And I think the other thing about The Wire and all the people that are involved in it is that they deeply love the subject. The subject ranges from the lowest trench of trench warfare in Baltimore all the way to the State Assembly in Annapolis. And we all have like this journalist's obsession with how does things really work? What is real politics? And at the same time, we sort of suspend judgment on like good people and bad people. And we're just in heaven, just picking up small stuff that there's no way you would know unless you were a witness.
Do that again.
Do what again?
Do that thing with your hand. Do it in my face.
Fuck you talking about. Oh, man.
He didn't do that. Got a lot of room in here.
Do what the fuck they want. Right. Don't even do nothing.
Fuck the police!
Nah, man. We was just hanging.
Just slinging.
You hear too, you get the feeling that these guys are, they're all collaborators out there. Police can't do their job without the bad guys telling them what's going on. And the bad guys can't stay out there unless the police have a reason to let them be out there. So it's all give and take. Everybody sees everybody every day. And life goes on. Nobody ever thinks of it as a war that's going to be won or, you know, come to an end in any way.
Fuck out of here.
How about a hand job?
Huh? Oh, man, you don't even get Wheezy Jefferson for a hand job.
Hey, Dozer Man.
Want to call it a day?
Okay. His brain's all over the sidewalk, but he's okay. What the hell you think?
She has one job on the show, and that's to be the interpreter.
Well, that's two we heard about.
What the hell's going on?
Drug war, maybe?
What's up? Nothing good, man. I ain't sleep since I capped his ass. Close my eyes. See him laying there bloody and shit. Jeez, man. You did what you had to do.
I started getting involved in this show after watching it for 2 years and thinking it was so good that I used to pretend that I wrote it, even though I hadn't, and hadn't done that in decades. I'd known David Simon. We had the same editor in the early 90s when I had written Freedom Land and Clockers, and he had written the book Homicide. And we actually had a play date once, going to Jersey City to watch the riots after the Rodney King decision. And he was putting out feelers to see if I would come on board for episode for year three. But my only fear of The Wire is that it was so richly nuanced and so complex, and everybody thinks that I know so much more about that world than I actually do. I was afraid of disappointing the people that write The Wire for not knowing enough. But I took a shot, George Pelicano, and so that's how I got involved.
Check it out, right? 6 reported auto thefts, 2 of which state not impossible car was borrowed, making 4 auto thefts with 2 unfounded. And the prize winner, 4 armed robberies, 2 of which complainant state too dark to ID weapon.
This is fighting crime by reinterpreting the word crime.
Wine into water.
There he is, Abba Dabba Berman.
Dr. Atkins of crime.
Abba Dabba Berman was Dutch Schultz's numbers man. And he was a genius at crunching numbers. That reference was probably lost on a lot of people.
Shit. Y'all go to the movies?
The Wire in general, what appeals to me
must be the lovely Mrs. Hurt.
Is when I first read Stephen Crane's Red Badge of Courage, there was a scene in there which I never forgot, which is you had the Union pickets, you had the Union camp on one side of a river, the rebel camp on the other side of the river. And each camp set up their pickets, their guards, on the banks. And the guards were in shouting distance of each other. And so, you know, the Yankee, picket just called across the river saying, what do you got to eat tonight, Johnny? And then the rebel guard would call back, hardtack, how about you? He said, nah, same here. And then they just small talk about what kind of food they like. And then they would end like, all right, we're going to have the big one tomorrow morning. You keep your head low, Johnny. You too, Billy. And the next day there was a battle royale. But that's the thing that stuck in my mind, that everybody thinks wrongly that the whole world is divided up into blacks and whites, you know, and communists and Americans, terrorists and freedom fighters. And, you know, it just doesn't work that way. Life is about an endless negotiation. And everybody's just trying to make it through the day. Well, most everybody is trying to make it through the day.
So, everything good? How's that Fontanette?
Fontanelle.
Is it closing up?
It won't close for a while.
Anybody who wants to know if Fontanelle is the open space in a baby's skull? Aren't you glad you asked?
But I'm just saying.
This scene now in real life just sort of about plays itself out in every major city. The Latino pickup at the train station or wherever.
I ain't sleep since I capped his ass. Close my eyes. See him laying there all bloody and shit.
Cheese.
Cheese on a platter. He never talks like that.
Now, why would...
Because all good things come to those who wait.
Does McNulty know?
I'll raise his ass.
We'll keep our ear to the wire, keep gathering string. No problem. But the bodies keep falling in the Eastern District. We might have to give up this wiretap.
Now you coming around. Been more than a damn year.
Looks just like his dad, huh? Let me ask you. When you heard D was a suicide, what'd you think? Here's the thing, we got a tip. The autopsy report, it backed us up.
Can you put him down, please?
This is another scene in which you had to have watched the year before to get the background and context of what they're talking about.
You know,
the
I'm
death
sorry
of D'Angelo
loss,
Barksdale, which was in year two.
Seemed like a pretty decent guy, all things considered.
She's right, it took a whole year for you to get to me, but that's real time for the show.
So when I found out about this, I felt like I owed him. The last thing I wanted to do was upset you if there was no point to it, so... if there's anything I can help with, or any questions you need answered, whatever.
Major, how many people under your command?
278, sir.
278. And how many felony arrests they make last month? Don't bother. You made 16. 16. In a month. Same time period, how many handguns you pick up? All shifts, all sectors. Once again,
the thing about the Comstat scenes, it's like when these guys are getting called on the carpet, it just feels like life is one endless bad junior high school experience of getting busted for not doing your homework. That all life is the struggle to do your homework and get the teacher off your back.
Tell me about this kid. Get a grip on this mess or you're done. You hear me? Done.
Marlo? You know I'm with Avon, right? String a bell? Can we talk?
I need you to walk back up there and pack up your people.
Marlo's great in this scene, except he's supposed to have been a lot more menacing with that golf club. He sort of looks like he's doing Taibo or something.
You offer up what you have on this, you start the clock running on yourselves. The wiretap has to surface in court. No way around it.
She's right. Finally got something worth listening to. You're talking about giving up the wire? Makes no sense.
There's a war going on. We might have four more buddies tonight.
This is Baltimore. He might have six.
I watched Marvin Taylor from the Eastern get his asshole ripped today because he has no fucking clue.
I don't believe this. We got top lieutenants talking about murders, and we can't figure out just to shut up and take notes.
We got bodies on the ground here. That's got
to believe per capita, Baltimore is the murder capital of America. They said if Baltimore had New York's population, the murder rate proportionally would be 4,000 a year.
Grinds me too. But the fact is, we didn't create this unit just to lock up dope dealers. There's a narcotics unit downtown for that. We're about violence, have been from the jump. Barksdale was violent. But right now, Stringer's quiet. And over on the east side, we got bodies.
Jimmy got enough from the tap to take a real good shot at Cheese.
Put a murder case or two together, you may be able to roll someone up at Proposition Joe or Stringer.
As far as bodies go, four's a big number.
Okay, then. As of now, we use the phones to work these murders.
Yo quiero mucho menos pastillas de sequoia en eso y muy más anco un poco. ¿Sí? Gracias.
The expression on his face is how I basically feel when I have to write this show.
Yo, we're bracing up, son. Huh? Handle yourself, nigga. We got a beat on Dash. Be at Nisi crib in an hour. Dash be with Nisi? I thought that was your girl. Ah, stupid.
Nisi, huh?
When we just hook it up there, go to the battle. Bring your whistle in an hour. One.
Mono. Caroline, call QRT with that 20 and stay on the wire. We're on channel 2.
All right.
When I was writing Clockers, I would go on raids with police occasionally to housing projects of Jersey City. And I was with them one night, and they had this thing. It was called a rabbit. It was a small pneumatic device that looked like a profile of a rabbit. And it had enough power that once you slipped it in between the door and its frame, and once the pneumatic power popped, that door would fly back like somebody hit it with a torpedo. And there's nothing more frightening for police than going through a door because you have no idea what's on the other side. So I was with all these guys tiptoeing their way up two flights of stairs. Everybody's breathless, quiet, silent. One guy opens up his gym bag. He takes out this rabbit. He's about to wedge it in between the door and the door frame. Everybody's heart's pumping Kool-Aid. And all of a sudden, this big, fat slob just opens the door with his back to all the cops and starts saying, like, how many fries? The cops are so flummoxed. You know, the guy's still holding the rabbit in his hand. Somebody had to snap out of it and say, go. But this kid was so huge, and it was such a narrow hallway, you needed an all-terrain vehicle to get over him to the guys who had the drugs at the other end of the hallway. That's the stuff I love. I'm more interested in the fat guy blocking the hallway than I am in how a pneumatic rabbit works.
Okay. Gus Triandos. Who's Gus Triandos?
He's a catcher with the Orioles back in the day.
Herc had to come up with the name of a guy he'd be willing to do a sex act with in order to have this fantasy sex with dream females. And I was just trying to go back and think of the most unlikely person that's connected to Baltimore. And I just thought of this guy I'd only seen on a baseball card in the early 60s and late 50s, Gus Triandos, who was a catcher. He just seemed so not appealing or unappealing, you know, just like some big guy. He had a hard time because Hoyt Wilhelm, who he caught for, had a knuckleball. He had to have a glove that was twice the size of any other catcher's glove because that knuckleball was so unpredictable. He gave in, I guess he got the joke. But that's why I'm a writer and not a producer, because I don't want to have to find the guy.
Okay, mount up.
So, Cheese, who's your dog?
You my dog.
I just want to know who's your dog. Dog.
What's this, some psychology? Huh? Yeah, okay, yo, please, stop. I'll tell you everything I know.
Come on, Cheese. Who's your dog?
Writing an episode, yes, it's a guarantee it'll go onto screen, but it's not a guarantee that everything you wrote will get up there. And it's not because the work you did is not good enough, but because you happen to be episode 3 or episode 8, and the pace of a character's trajectory before you has slowed down or sped up in a way that they couldn't anticipate until they got to your episode. So either your character shouldn't be saying what he's saying quite yet, and therefore stuff somebody else wrote has to be bumped into your episode. The stuff that you wrote about that character has to be bumped forward. So what happens is you lose a bunch of scenes and you pick up a bunch of orphans from earlier scenes.
I
thought he punked me, all right? So I did what I had to do.
So I would say, you know, if you're lucky, if 75 to 80% of what you wrote with your name on it is stuff you actually wrote, you're doing well. Some of the stuff that I write, I literally feel like I just take dictation. The city hall stuff, the bureaucratic infighting. I honestly don't know anything about that. I go to a guy, Bill Zors, who I think he worked on the city desk at the Baltimore Sun for a number of years and is an expert at, you know, the nuances of politics. And basically, he almost dictates a scene to me. Now, what I have to do is to take that information and sort of give it a spin so it feels like mine, and it sort of has more of an element of drama and less perfunctoriness to it. But I never feel like I own those scenes. I feel like a fraud to say that I own those scenes.
Warehouse on the east side.
But I'm glad they're there.
As far as I know, unless the SPCA come around.
What? Looks like they broke it.
I gotta say, you really showed me something on this.
What can I possibly add to that, except... I owe you one, Cedric. You ever have one of those have your cake and eat it 2 days? I believe this could be my first. Tell me something good.
We're charging him.
Improper disposal of an animal, discharging a firearm in city limits.
Animal cruelty, you want to run wild with it.
Go ahead. Call me a cocksucker. You know you want to.
Excuse me. You know, I actually looked up the stats on Gus Triandos. Power hitter, right?
Fuck the both of you.
Funny day. I'm the new departmental pet for shutting down a drug war. But I blew my wife for a dead terrier.
You remember how you said you hoped today would be your first have your cake and eat it too day?
What about it?
Okay, gents, you see the brake lights pump twice, you know we got a clean hand-to-hand.
So I get in this morning and I'm looking at 3 phone messages from Buddy Ferraro over at DPW, all assuring me that I'll have 20 radio cars back in service at the end of the week.
Buddy and my old man go way back. May the first community...
One of the great things about this show is... explains to you just like how things work,
so
and how it's all about your ability to hold liquor and keep your wits about you.
Did you get your cars?
And just talk about very, very small things.
Did anyone get fucked over it, or did your job just get a little easier?
I got 70 cops retiring at the end of the year that I know of, and no money for academy class.
Well, the mayor fucked you. Because I know that money was in the budget.
The mayor delayed it till next summer. I mean, less troops, less salary, less bennies. I mean, even 6-month delay saves the city $2-3 million.
Well, let me talk to some people.
I don't know any show or any book or anything in the arts that stops and examines every scrap of paper and tiny pebble in the street, because they're all lead to the big thing. Most shows just go to the big thing.
Which hospital?
I just got the lease, so.
The original makeout scene that I wrote was an hour and 50 minutes long. I don't know, I guess they had to cut it down for time.
Fucked up. Dead ass motherfuckers, dead. We catch up to him, he don't come in alive. Right?
Chill out, old man.
Nick Jugular, shattered jaw. He'll live. Got back from shock trauma. Guy saved his ass getting him down as fast as you did. So what we got for a suspect?
Number one male, white t-shirt, baggy jeans, tennis shoes.
In the wind. But we're locking it down out there.
So what's this I hear about the gun?
Those try to return fire, drop this piece, some fuck picks it up and books. I mean, I can't believe this shit.
Sometimes you write scenes that are supposed to go a lot farther. Like, she was actually supposed to pick up another woman in this scene. But then when they look at the big overview of 12 scenes, 12 episodes, 35 scenes each, they decide things got to be slowed down. So what you wrote for your episode, they decide shouldn't happen until the next episode because things are going too fast. Same thing with Who Shot Dozerman. There was supposed to be a scene in which they get the guy and they beat the crap out of him. But they wanted to slow that down, too.
Tell him I'm cooked. I just got done to the hospital. I'm all in.
Well, he was asking if you could maybe talk to the reporters.
No, you don't want me talking to reporters right now.
All right.
That would truly be unwise. All right.
Bunny, you look hellacious.
Got any coffee going in there? You know what I was thinking? Well, tonight's a good night. Why? Because my shot cop didn't die. And he hit me. This is what makes a good night on my watch. Absence of a negative.
It was a good night.
Here's the thing. 6 months from now, I'm gone. I put in my 30. The only thing gonna be left of me on that job is a 8x11 frame picture on the Western hallway. But you know what? The shit out there. The city. It's worse than when I first came on. So, what does that say about me? About my life?
Oh, come on, man. You're talking about drugs. That's a force of nature. That's sweeping leaves on a windy day, whoever the hell you are. You fought the good fight.
Not a call since we gave it up to Cheese.
What'd you expect?
Tantrum.
Be seated. Regarding Officer Dozerman, his condition has been...
This whole scene in which the major is substituting the drugs in the paper bag for the beer bottle, it originated out of, I believe it was a homicide, the book that David wrote with, or it might even have been The Corner, the one he co-wrote with Ed Burns. But it's the whole notion of, like, how can we all function out here? How can you guys live and do what you got to do? Because we know you're always going to do it. And how can we ignore it without losing our respect? And so what Major Colvin comes up with is this notion of, like, how to make the drugs officially invisible, even though everybody knows where they are. And what he does is he comes up, contain you here, and we're going to watch all the numbers, the crime numbers, go down everywhere else in Baltimore. And that's his utopia. And the thrust of the season is how a utopia turns to a dystopia.
All kind of dystopia.
Like, what a nightmare an idea can become, no matter how good the intentions. But the whole idea of Amsterdam is hiding the drugs in a paper bag. The paper bag is the arrest-free zone. And it's got to be a dirty secret, because this is one of the things that if anybody gets a hold of this, like a newspaper or the higher brass, heads are going to roll. And Colvin only has the nerve to do it now because, as he says, he spent 30 years on the street, and the situation is worse than when he started, and what does that make him? And it's a last hurrah. It's a statement. It's a raised fist to the establishment saying, this is the only thing that's going to work. And he damn well knows it's got a very small shelf life. It's going to be exposed. It's going to be disemboweled. But he just wants to make his statement. And he wants all these cops to be in heaven because the numbers, because they're obsessed with numbers, all the numbers, the crime stats going down, ecstatic. And then when they find out, well, the real reason why, it's going to shake everybody up. I mean, it's not going to, you know, make Amsterdam a permanent fixture, but he is going to make his statement. He's going out with this big last hurrah.
For drugs. Until now.
If we ain't doing hand-to-hands, then what the fuck? Man, that shit with the bag? What the fuck is that?
And life goes on. One of the good things about this show is that it sort of forces you to embrace the day-to-dayness of everything. And it's sort of like combat, which is it's 98% nothing, 2% sheer terror. And if you can get into the rhythm of what they're offering, I mean, I think it's a watching experience that no one's ever had. I just want to say, and I'm sure David and Ed feel this, you know, much, much more strongly than I do because they knew him so much better. It was a tremendous loss for the show this year was the sudden death of Bob Colesbury. He was like this dream producer. He was diligent. He was on top of everything. He didn't try to impose his creative will. People really relied on him. And it was one of those deaths that just left people dumbfounded. Thank you for listening. This is Richard Price, the writer for episode 302, All Due Respect.